You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO's 2024 Catalog of Connections is hot off the presses. To get your copy featuring your favorite programs, letters from the board, and so much more, contact our membership director by calling 971-801-1381. That's 971-801-1381 or by emailing membership@kboo.org. We can't wait to connect with you.
Tune in to Cubby Cushy, Cubby Cush, Tuesday nights on KBOO. 2 hours of global bass with an emphasis on South Asia and the South Asian diaspora, and an even more special emphasis on the Punjabi diaspora. Hosted every Tuesday, 10 to midnight, by The Incredible Kid. This ain't world music, it's birth of a new world music.
Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, your volunteer-powered, member-supported, nonprofit community radio station. I'm your host today, Fran Michelle, reminding you that this month is KBOO's Catalog of Connections year-end campaign, where we're giving the gift of grassroots community media. Please help us reach our goal of $75,000 before December 31st. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 or mail a check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. On the Old Mole today, we'll hear about people making connections with land and with history and culture and with each other. Our first segment is produced by Tim Rice of the Municipal Eco-Resiliency Project, MERP, which is working with Portland households to ramp up food production and advance food sovereignty and climate justice by developing a neighborhood-level network of urban farm cooperatives. He brings us the voices of Malcolm Shabazz Hoover and Daniel Grady of Black Futures Farm in Southeast Portland, part of the Black Food Sovereignty Coalition. Then we dip into the Old Mole Variety Hour Holiday Archive to hear an interview Bill Resnick did with Alexandra Holstrom Smith, who wrote the article, "Leftists Need Holidays Too, Let's Imagine Anti-Oppressive Ones." They discuss the need to reinterpret traditional holidays and to create new ones that preserve our histories and extend our communities. Finally today, we hear another favorite from the Old Mole Archive, in which Joe Clement and their guest Dennis Gravy review the classic Christmastime cartoon, A Charlie Brown Christmas. They consider anti-commercialism, alienation, cultural appropriation, white supremacy, and why the workers' revolution that seems to promise an answer to Charlie Brown's problems falls flat. As ever, you'll be able to find this episode of the Old Mole Variety Hour and links to more information about the segments on the KBOO website at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, where you can also find links to subscribe to our show and to join and support your listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered, nonprofit community radio station by clicking on the red Donate tab. Here are Malcolm Hoover and Daniel Grady of Black Futures Farm.
My name is Malcolm Shabazz Hoover. We're at Black Futures Farm in Southeast Portland. How did Black Futures Farm come about? Well, we, a lot like MERP, are kind of a direct product of Mudbone Grown and Art and Shantae's effort to start educating people around growing their own food and sustainability and community. Mirabai and I were the co-founders. Mirabai is my partner and co-founder and partner in crime and wife. We participated in a grant project that Mudbone Grown had that became We Grow PDX. And at that kind of at We Grow PDX, we had another plot that we community gardened at 60th and Simpson in the Northeast. And every Sunday we gathered there to like hang out and grow food and talk and just be together. There's so many confluences. Like the person who had this site before was my teacher for the Master Gardener program, Weston Miller. This where we are used to be the beginning urban farm apprenticeship program. And so they put in a lot of the infrastructure that we came in over. And so that program went out of operation. I was in the Master Gardener program under Weston. I knew him. This was available. We were looking for land to like plant our own farm. And all of it just kind of came together. We took occupancy in the winter of 2019. So this will be our fifth year, but our fourth season growing. We practice low-till, no-till farming. So that means that we don't really till the soil except totally by necessary. And we're working on becoming a clean energy farm.
So a few of the things we do, we grow produce. In addition to growing produce, we grow community. We do that through farming. A good way of doing that is putting your hands in the ground. We do farmers markets, donate to food trucks, volunteers. We also do pop-up days where people can just come out and grab produce. So lots of ways to connect the community. So I'm farming on about 1.15 acres. The total site space is about 5 acres, but 1.15 acres is what we're farming on. And we can put quite a bit of produce, get a pretty big yield out of this space. Lots of Pacific Northwest staples. A few things we grow are culturally specific. So I'll grow things that are really near and dear to me, such as sweet potatoes, eggplant, okra, scallions, there's onions, beets, lettuce, spinach, tomatoes, peppers, onions, chard, collards, kale, cabbage, culinary and medicinal herbs. So lots of things, a few different fruit trees. Yeah, pear, apple. So there's usually something for everybody. So we have quite a few ways to get involved. People could either volunteer. Volunteer days are Mondays between 10 and 1. Or they could, if they don't necessarily have a green thumb or lots of plant knowledge, there's always something that somebody has to offer, regardless if it's in the dirt or not. We'd always love to have experience. More heads are better than one.
We're not a capitalist enterprise. Our goal is not to make money. Our goal is to make change and feed people. And we do a really good job of writing grants with that mission in mind. And we think that what we do is important. And so, not that money shouldn't be the problem, but we have a really small budget and we do a lot of work with like not a lot of money. But even if it was billions of dollars, we would redistribute that money back out to the community where it belongs and is most needed. So we're grant funded. We do have some small revenue stream because we will go to farmers markets and, you know, there are restaurants who do insist on buying our produce. Lewis and Clark is one of those places. Their kitchen buys produce from us. Yeah, and in terms of logistics, we're community-based, so we know we have real-life relationships with the people in these foundations, and we always are just trying to find ways to work together. And so when we find out somebody has a way to, like, distribute the produce, we want to get it to them. We have a couple delivery vehicles that we just, you know, we load up and we take our stuff over there and they take it and we come back and keep working. Mudbone Grown, Wapato Island Farms, Feed 'em Freedom Foundation, the local food bank folks. We donate across the street to Lane Middle School to their pantry. We donate to a couple other pantries. We're always here to support POC, BIPOC businesses, women-owned businesses, queer-owned businesses. We are in partnership with the flower farmer here, Zandy. We are community-based, so, you know, this is not a commercial enterprise. This is a community enterprise, and so our specific purpose is to reconnect Black people to the land, but kind of simultaneously and alongside that, we're here to support just our local infrastructure of people who are growing food and learning and growing together and organizing. Like, that's what we do here. I mean, you can come here and hang out with us. You can go to any of our websites. You can go to Black Futures Farm, blackfutures.farm. You can go to Mudbone Grown. You can go to the Black Food Sovereignty, Black Food Sovereignty Coalition, BFSC, blackfoodnw.org. You know, you can come to the Come Through Market. So Black Futures Farm is a founding member of the Black Food Sovereignty Coalition. I'm the chair of the board of the Black Food Sovereignty Coalition also. And we're a program of the Black Food Sovereignty Coalition. Black sovereignty is when you control your own community. You know, when I'm in control of what food comes in here or what jobs are here or where the money goes or how the money is spent, that's sovereignty. You know, when you have control over your own system, that's sovereignty. There's more young people of color, who are looking at farming. You know, and like all trends, everybody ain't built for it, you know? And I had to discover that I was, and I had to fail a lot, you know, and shit didn't grow, and there was accidents out here. I was at work one day, and that thing burst because we didn't turn off properly and exploded and was shooting water and ice everywhere, and I had to come out here and it was always the only person that could fix it, you know. And we planted things that just didn't grow, or like we had been fighting morning glory, or like, you know, there's all kind of stuff that doesn't work out where it's easy to get discouraged and nobody would be mad at me if I just walked away from it. But I'm not built like that, to walk away from difficult things. And I've learned, this has been a place of great learning for me. And I think that is also intriguing for people, because so little in our society is built to like truly stimulate you and make you look deeply. And growing will make you look deeply at things and reflect, and it'll slow you down, you know, and calm you and soothe you and excite you. And, you know, like So it's a way of life that a lot of people are rediscovering. I'm in recovery from drugs. And when I worked at the food bank, it was really early in my recovery. And I used to go outside and like hang out with Art and Shantae and just like process. And one day Art says, "Blood, we love talking to you, but we don't get no work done. So if you want to come out here and hang out with us, like do some work." I was like, "Oh yeah, show me what to do. Like, please put me to work, you know?" And so he showed me how to weed. And like, I just was in joy, you know, like the second my hand touched the soil, like that instant, like I started to feel better in a way that I had never felt in a 12-step meeting or in a counseling session or anything. It was like, oh, this is what I need to heal. And so I just stuck with them, and I was out there like every day. And they started inviting me to community things, and like very slowly, not even slowly, but like gradually, this community of farmers and growers, I got to know them, and they became my family, you know. And I met my wife through this community, and like I really love it. Like, I really love farming. I love growing things. I love plants. I love the soil. I love all the critters that live in the soil. I love the science of it, the community organizing part. Like, I love all of this work. I love all of this. And selfishly, I do it because it's good for the people, but it's also healing for me. And as somebody who's in recovery, who really harmed himself and my family and people who love me, this is where I find my healing, and I'm able to, like, you know, do my best to repair that damage.
It's just fun being out here, connecting, seeing something grow. I've learned a lot of patience in farming, just being really patient when putting stuff in the ground. It's not gonna happen overnight. Same thing with anything in life, you know. Patience is a virtue. I think that's a quality that I've learned.
Well, just on a practical level, I mean, we need to have more people who know how to grow their own food, you know, like, just practically as a skill. Like, you know, you should know how to, like, work on your car. You should know how to, like, fix things around your house. You should know how to clean effectively. And you should also know how to grow your own food. And I hope that enough of us stick such that in every neighborhood, there should be several people who know how to grow food, so we can share food with each other and, like, teach our neighbors. And, like, you know, like, there should be neighborhood mechanics and dentists and, you know, doctors and nurses and farmers. I feel like it's a part of being a human being. And also, it's a way to resist capitalism, and it's a way to keep yourself healthy. And, like, you know, a lot of the food in the stores is, like, way overprocessed and treated with chemicals so it looks good. And, like, I have a relationship with my food. You know, this, I eat a lot of what we grow here. I eat, I take it home, and I make it, and I know it. Capitalism is really interesting because it relies on interdependence, but it relies on interdependence in a way that's exploitive and dangerous and harmful. And we really believe in communalism. I personally, this is my own personal philosophy, I believe in communalism, which is to each his own, you know, or her own, to each their own. You take according to what you need, and you give according to what you can. The more people that approach that kind of good spirit, the better off things are for everybody. We can see in real time that climate is changing drastically. And for us to, like, as growers and producers, try to, like, change this food system such that we've extended our growing season, you know, so we put up things to try to access alternate forms of energy in case the grid goes down, as it did in Puerto Rico and a lot of other places, to try to find alternate forms of, like, cold storage. So we're working on an ingrown cold storage model here to try to foster and promote more local growers so that you don't have to go very far to find food. If we promote more people to grow in their neighborhoods, then you won't have to worry about, you have to worry less about a food crisis if you're growing food in your backyard. And many of your neighbors are, y'all know that you can keep yourselves fed. So to promote that kind of, like, thinking, and, like, us looking at different things to grow more, maybe, like, hotter weather crops or things with an extended season, to teach each other how to do storage, is really meaningful. I mean, to prepare ourselves in a lot of ways to reclaim this knowledge that our ancestors had of, like, preserving food and storing food and how to process food with, like, very minimal technology is really important, because we know where this is going. We see how these systems are breaking down, or how they get stressed in extreme weather conditions. If we are locally organized and resilient, then we're gonna be okay. If you have good infrastructure and you're cool with your neighbors and you kind of know how to help one another and you know what skills each other have, like, you're gonna be a lot better off. And I really am trying to help create that kind of resiliency in this community.
We're coming toward the end of days where people need to be ready and know how to farm, or at least know somebody who knows how to farm. I know we seem so far removed from things because we're in what we consider a first world country, but that's not always the case. So it's good to be able to know how to do this, reconnect to your ancestry, eat foods that are good for you while they're in season, and just being conscious of what's being put in your food, or who's growing your food, where your food's coming from. It's good to have a say-so in that. Food sovereignty and food justice are things that we like to talk about a lot. So it's not an end goal. It's something that we've got to continue to do. It means having sovereignty, having control over what you're growing and what you're eating. It's a good feeling not to be told or have to guess what is what and where things are coming from. It always makes me feel good inside when I see someone come out here and say, oh wow, I didn't know an onion grew like that, or that corn or garlic kind of looks similar. So it's always really nice to have that feeling. Just knowing I was a part of the change or doing my part to make things better. Connecting people, all kinds of people, no agenda, just making sure people are taken care of, safe, eating good food, being knowledgeable about food, having control over their food. Just being overall good people.
Tap in with a couple people, tell them you want to volunteer, and then just be present and make yourself useful and let them know that you're trying to be a good part of this movement. And like, you know, get in where you fit in. Like, if you know you're good at writing, you know, help people write grants. If you're good at harvesting and you have a lot of energy, you know, help them find places for their produce to go. Or like, yeah, if you're good at science, you know, like, ask them if they've had their soil sampled. Just be of service. Like, try to use what you know how to do or what you would like to learn to be of service, and you'll find a good place to be. I want this to be a place where Black people know that they're safe and loved and valued, and that we center other Black people and we center Black joy and Black liberation. I never imagined that we were going to be where we are today. So I knew that we were going to be successful and that people were going to participate and they would like it here and we would grow good food. I'm confident of that. Like, I'm a good grower. Mirabai's a great grower. Like, I've been organizing for a long time. You know, I really enjoy it and I think I'm good at it. So I knew that those basic parts would be intact. I didn't know that it would become like the magnet that it has become, or that we would get as much positive attention as we have. I didn't know that. But Mira always says, just do the next right thing. And so, because that has been like our guiding philosophy, like, what's the next right thing for us to do? You know, how can we be more impactful in our community? How can we hold people and help them and just be here and be good neighbors and be in good community? If that is our guiding principle and not how much money we can make or how many Instagram followers we get or that old, like, if we're like authentic, if we continue to be authentic and true and like operate out of a space of love for our people in the community, then we're going to be okay. And that's really all I'm worried about. And so I would hope that that kind of flexible mentality and that thinking of like centering Black joy and Black liberation in your daily tasks and to be solution oriented is something that when you come here and you're around us long enough and you see how this way of we are working with each other is about that and not about making a dollar, and yet we thrive together, that is like my philosophical take on it. In a material sense, I would hope that we could create Black Futures Farm in ways that make sense in other communities, not just this one, so that there would be a network of Black Futures Farms, a global network, and that we would continue to grow and deepen in these ways of being practically useful to our communities, you know, and being a place of resilience, like a resiliency hub, and of growth and education and nutrition and health. And, you know, like, I want, when you come to a Black Futures Farm, you should have a positive experience in so many different ways. You should learn, you should be fed, you should laugh, you should feel safe, you should experience joy and wonder, you know, and I want that to be, the legacy. Free the land. Free Palestine. Touch some dirt.
Look at you smiling, shining, beaming like the sunshine, rising, climbing, grinding through the hard times, growing, showing up like you're a star. Cause no matter where you stand today, I hope you know you are. Keep on flowing in your grace.
Worthy. That was Mavis Staples singing Worthy, and before that, Malcolm Shabazz Hoover and Daniel Grady talking about their work at Black Futures Farm in Southeast Portland. I'm Fran Michel, and this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. We are in KBOO's Catalog of Connections year-end campaign to raise $75,000 by the end of December. Thank you to the 10% of listeners who contribute to making KBOO possible. Please join us and donate as much as you are able by going to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321 or mailing a check to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. We turn now to a conversation between Bill Resnick and Alexandra Holstrom Smith about leftists creating anti-oppressive holidays.
Alex Holmstrom Smith, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Alexandra Holmstrom Smith is an activist and an employment lawyer born and raised in New York City. In graduate school, Alex was active in her union, UAW 2865, which represents graduate student employees at the University of California. Today, Alex organizes with the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. She sings in its Solidarity Choir. Alex is also a writer. She's written down on a variety of socialist and feminist issues, including labor, commercial surrogacy, gun politics. Recently, Alex wrote an important article, Leftists Need Holidays Too. Let's imagine anti-oppressive ones. And more recently, I suspect partly for the purpose of building holidays and celebration, Alex co-founded the Red Cosmos Society, a new collective for building a revolutionary secular community. So, Alex, tell us how and why you got interested in alternative celebrations and holidays and memorials.
So, I've always been interested in left-wing culture. I'm a red diaper baby. My parents were in the International Socialist Organization and then Solidarity when I was growing up. And I also went to Camp Kinderland, which is one of the few remaining summer camps that were founded by communists and socialists in the 1930s. Back when the left was much bigger, they had kind of a whole suite of community social activities and institutions. So that's one that kind of has remained. And so, you know, at the camp, we learned about history of left movements. We sang a lot of songs from different movements, and I always loved that. But then when it came to holidays, we always kind of celebrated Christmas in a little bit of a slightly ironic ways, maybe. We put a red star at the top of our Christmas tree, and we put political buttons on mixed in with the ornaments, and, you know, we made it our own thing. But it was always a little bit funny to me because, like, I was raised as an atheist, and my cousins who always come on Christmas are Jewish. So it's just kind of like, why are we even celebrating Christmas? It's like a little bit of an odd thing, but it's just, you know, what we did. But other things I felt like I was kind of lacking when it came to holidays or ritual ways of dealing with phases of life, for example. So I did have some friends who had a bat mitzvah when they were growing up, and I didn't have that. I didn't actually know anyone in my close friends who did that. But I remember my mom talking about it, like, should we do some kind of ceremony for coming of age? But it was very ambiguous. And then when my grandma died, I realized that, you know, we were a little bit kind of starting from scratch in terms of what did we want to do to have a commemoration for her death, and how did we want to even deal with the body itself, and, you know, all of these things that are often kind of guided by religious traditions. We were sort of starting from scratch, and I felt like that made it harder in some ways because we were kind of just didn't have a playbook. So I always liked science fiction, and some years ago I was reading this book, The Parable of the Sower and The Parable of the Talents by Octavia Butler, and in it she has a character who starts her own religion, and it's about, like, humans' destiny to go to space. And I just remember reading that and feeling like, oh yeah, like, you can just start new things, you know? Like, there's no reason that we have to keep doing the old traditions, or that you can't just found a new tradition. So that was kind of how I got the idea. And then once I started, you know, I talked with my friends and stuff. And once I came up with our first holiday, which was May Day, we wanted to do May Day Eve, it's called, the night before May Day, which we can talk about that more later. But, you know, once I started it, I was like, well, I don't take it seriously. No one else is going to take it seriously. So I had to be committed to doing it every year, you know, no matter what. So that's just sort of how I got into it. And it's been about 5 years now, I think.
You know, reading your article, I had the sense that part of your motivation was sort of revulsion for many of our official holidays and even more of the sort of made-up holidays by the candy sellers or the many people who are predating on people's need for holidays and ceremonies and role-playing of different kinds, like the Mardi Gras, the Super Bowl. All of them are really corporate festivals that develop corporate sorts of ideas that make them sacred almost. And I think that's part of it. But I also have the sense that once you got into it, you were really inspired. And, you know, it's like a really a good rally sometimes where there's singing and good talks. You feel sort of one with people and you recognize that you're not alone. In fact, many of my old Jobs with Justice meetings and Old Mole meetings and many others, they can be really inspiring. Did I read your thing correctly, or was I projecting my own affection for ceremonies and being together with people?
Yeah, no, and for sure.
Why don't you talk about some of the hideous holidays that they have, like Columbus Day?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, mainstream holidays, unsurprisingly, have been completely co-opted by capitalism. I mean, at one point they may have had some, you know, more formal religious significance, but at this point, yeah, it's an excuse for companies to sell people stuff, right? I mean, Christmas, also Black Friday after Thanksgiving, it's repulsive. I mean, people have died in stampedes at like Walmart, and I just can't think of any more fitting example of just how horrible our consumer culture is in this country. And then when it comes to the actual like historical origins of these things, I mean, a good friend of mine from graduate school, Amr Solomon Johnson, just wrote an article on why Thanksgiving should be abolished, because from her perspective as an indigenous activist, there's just no redeeming that colonial history and making it some kind of nice, cozy thing about being thankful and gratitude and whatnot, because it actually is founded based on this false history of this supposed happy cooperation between early colonists and, you know, Native peoples, when we know, in fact, the early history was one of genocide and horrible murder. And, you know, same thing with Columbus Day, right? So it's really jarring for a lot of people who are aware of that history and kind of know about those things. But Thanksgiving is the day that we all have off. And so people, that's when they can meet with their families. And they do want to get together with family and friends and, you know, do celebrations. So it's almost like we all just get kind of herded into these existing traditions. But for people who have a different perspective, sometimes they can reinterpret an existing holiday in some new way that is meaningful for them. But a lot of people, it's like not really good enough. And so it just continues to be kind of a source of cognitive dissonance in terms of, you know, your values and your politics and sort of like, what are we commemorating on these dates?
Yeah, Columbus Day is a great example because, in fact, the indigenous have called attention to the real Columbus. He didn't discover America. What he did was torture the people, the indigenous who he encountered, tortured and murdered them in his pursuit of gold. Very little of it was in their hands, the indigenous Taino people. But they've also, at least at KBOO, we do celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day, where we talk about the civilizations that were invaded and destroyed and the genocides in Latin America under the Spanish, but then continuing. It seems to me that going at those holidays in that way provides an opening for talking, especially to kids, how early capitalism operated before it was semi-civilized, which it's not actually. There's still a huge amount of deaths, in fact. It seems to me that challenging those days is not only instructive, but it challenges people's sense of how the country works. And you can go from challenging Columbus Day to talking about the NRA and the gun lobby. We can talk about the amount of deaths that they, in fact, cause and why they do it. Anyway, why don't you reply?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that the existing holidays can be a pedagogical tool for young people and, you know, for the public to, yeah, question some of our consumer culture, our colonial history, and everything in between. I think when I was, in maybe high school or a while back, sometimes I would attend these anti-sweatshop protests in Midtown with, I believe it was called the National Labor Committee, and they were calling for, you know, people to shop with a conscience or maybe not to shop at all, you know, but using the holiday season when they know a lot of people are shopping to get people's attention around labor conditions in, you know, the factories that were making these clothes. And yeah, even now, like my chorus, Sing in Solidarity, which is the chorus of New York CSA, we do a caroling thing every year, and we do a mix of kind of reinterpreting Christmas carols with different lyrics, you know, so we have some lyrics about canceling rent to the tune of the dreidel song and, you know, stuff like that, which is just entertaining, you know, but it's kind of a hook to bring people in. But we also have a song that is kind of more serious. That's kind of the story of Jesus as a working man and how he was like a proto-communist kind of character. So that's a different angle, right? Of like taking the religious aspect of the holiday seriously and then trying to, you know, make an argument that the real values really align more with socialism than with capitalist consumer version of Christmas.
Yeah, Christmas is, after all, it can be seen, and you pointed out, as objectionable because it elevates one man to become king. It's tremendously patriarchal in some ways. But in other ways, it seems to me that it can be used exactly like the PSA in New York in their satirical song did. After all, Jesus was a Jewish communist, basically, who tried to clean out the temple, the money changers from the temple, and fought the Romans. And the Romans actually gave him some chances to live if he wouldn't continue his efforts. And he refused and rejected. The real Jesus, it seems to me, is a remarkable figure. In any event, Christmas also could be thought of as a holiday that actually supports the challenge to illegitimate authority that the Romans had in Palestine in that period.
Yeah.
So this is Bill Resnick talking to Alex Holmes from Smith on the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio. She wrote an important article, Leftists Need Holidays. Let's imagine anti-oppressive ones. We just covered why Alex Holmes from Smith became increasingly interested and in fact committed to organizing holidays and ceremonies that inspire, that educate, and that, as she said in her essay, that inspire collective memories and knowledge and pleasure. Alex, you've also created and organizing two holidays that are now going on yearly. Tell us about them.
Yeah, so one of the first holidays that I organized is called May Day Eve, and I kind of modeled it after Passover. And the idea was, you know, May Day on the day of, I didn't want to conflict with that because sometimes there are big marches that unions do and different kinds of things that are already on the table. But I thought it would be nice to have some time also around May Day to have a more reflective kind of event, or, you know, to an opportunity to reflect on the history of May Day and the history of worker struggle and to do that in community with people. So I kind of took the idea of doing it the night before, and we have a dinner and we talk about the history of May Day. We talk about the worker struggle, and we, you know, we found some different ways to kind of incorporate it into the meal to make it memorable. So one thing I did early on was I decided we should all sing Bread and Roses, and then I made a cake that was flavored with rose water. And we talked about how, you know, the meaning of the Bread and Roses song and how it's about how workers also deserve to have not just, you know, bread to survive, but also beauty and art and, you know, good things in life. And so that was kind of eating dessert after the meal that was kind of symbolic of that. And then we started doing this other thing. You know, May Day comes out of the struggle of the 8-hour day, which was the big demand at the time of the Haymarket riot. And the struggle for the 8-hour day, the slogan was 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will. And so we started doing this thing where we would have eight little like spicy things, like 8 wasabi peas or 8 dabs of wasabi to symbolize, you know, our suffering and our work. And then we have 8 little bland crackers or something, and then 8 of whatever you want of different snacks. People could pick what they wanted. Or I also, one time I made a plate with like assorted things around the plate. And, you know, it maybe seems a little corny, but it's just a kind of a way to remember the struggle for the 8-hour day. And it's fun to do together. And, you know, we usually have some poetry reading and we have a little time for some songs. And so that's a really nice event that we do in May. And then the other one that I've been doing for a while is called Martyrs Day. And it's, you know, kind of loosely inspired by Dia de Muertos or other kinds of ancestor veneration types of practices. So I called it, you know, Martyrs Day. Is a little bit loose because it doesn't only have to be about martyrs, but we wanted to basically expand the concept of ancestry beyond just your biological family. So thinking of political figures from the past who maybe you look up to in some way or inspired you, that could be like your chosen ancestor, you know, with the concept of chosen family that people have. And, you know, part of what I'm trying to do is to create or reinforce a kind of sense of shared identity, that we are people committed to a struggle for a better world, that we're not alone. We're doing it together with other people today, and we're also continuing the struggles of people in the past. And, you know, I think the implication is that hopefully people will continue the same struggle in the future after you and I are long gone. So for those of us who don't necessarily believe in an afterlife, it's still, you know, we care about what happens in the material world. And I think these kinds of traditions can encourage people. I mean, we can't control the future, but we can encourage people to continue these traditions and to hopefully remember some of the work that people are doing now and to continue doing it. So for that holiday, we talk about the importance of remembering the past. We have some space for each person to talk about someone that they want to remember. And again, it can be, you know, a political figure from the past, or it could be a family member, you know, someone who had an impact on their life. And it could be also, you know, someone whose death you think should not go unmarked. And I think it's important that we do these practices because, you know, our history is told by the winners and by the ruling class, basically, right? So, you know, it's only by retelling stories that we're going to remember the, you know, lives of working people and, you know, people who are marginalized from society in different kinds of ways. So we kind of have that time to talk about different people that we want to remember. And I've done some research and found a bunch of songs from the left tradition, you know, different left traditions from different places and different times that are about different martyrs or about just a general idea of martyrdom or of remembering people who have passed on. And we sing a bunch of those songs. And, you know, it's also kind of pedagogically useful, I think, because, well, number one, because you're learning stories, like there's a song about Sacco and Vanzetti, the famous Italian anarchist wrongfully executed by the United States in the early 20th century. So everyone who comes to Martyrs Day, if they hadn't heard of Sacco and Vanzetti before, now they have, you know, so that's part of the point of it. And then also, you know, there's some, like there's a song called Beloved Comrade that's just about remembering a beloved comrade and pledging to continue the struggle after their death. And, you know, those are things that there's a lot of shared themes that you'll find in the literature of poems and songs from the left about sort of how we interpret and, you know, really deal with our own mortality. And I think, you know, finding that those themes in the literature is useful for people who are, you know, basically orienting their lives around this kind of struggle. I mean, we've also made an altar in the past with people who can put like pictures of their person that they want to talk about. And, you know, I like crafts, so I'm always big for all the holidays. I have lots of flowers and make everything look pretty, you know, which is part of making sure that also our traditions and everything that we also, it's kind of like honoring the people that we're talking about and also making it an expression of our aesthetic commitments as well, I guess.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon, the Old Mole Variety Hour. You just heard Bill Resnick, that's me, interviewing Alex Holmstrom Smith on the need for the left to develop holidays, rituals, ceremonies, that carry a message that another better world, a democratic, sustainable world, is necessary and possible. And Alex gave numerous examples. For more discussion, I recommend listeners go to her wonderful essay on the website Truthout, Leftists Need Holidays Too. Let's imagine anti-oppressive ones. Alex Holmstrom Smith, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for having me. Oh, hear the people singing, red and roses.
Oh, hear the people singing, red and roses. That was Ann Feeney singing Bread and Roses. And before that, Bill Resnick talking with Alexandra Holmstrom Smith about leftists creating anti-oppressive holiday celebrations. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michelle, reminding you that this is KBOO's Catalog of Connections year-end campaign to raise $75,000. You can connect with us by becoming a member and giving to KBOO, so please go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or click on the red donate box in the mobile app, or snail mail your paper check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Finally today, we hear Joe Clement and their guest, Dennis Gravy, review the classic Christmastime cartoon, A Charlie Brown Christmas.
In 1965, Charles Schulz's comic strip Peanuts, which had already been in newspapers for 15 years, appeared on National Network Television in the form of A Charlie Brown Christmas. A mere 25 minutes long, not counting commercials, the story starts with Charlie expressing his signature anxiety and depression around the coming Christmas season. He says he's not happy like he feels he's supposed to, or sees in his peers, and that despite getting gifts and material things and doing family Christmas rituals that he likes, he's still unhappy. As new main characters are introduced, they display some sort of grating affirmation of what Charlie Brown deplores as commercialism. The character Lucy suggests that Charlie Brown get involved to combat his alienation, specifically in directing a school Christmas play. When he shows up, no one seems to take him very seriously, and it's eventually decided the play needs a Christmas tree. Charlie goes out to buy one, but can only find a limp sapling of a tree. This leads to more ridicule. Charlie Brown tries to decorate the tree, but gives up and walks off. In the next and final scene, the whole cast appears and collectively transforms the tree, almost by magic, into a spectacle of its former self. Charlie Brown returns, elated, and they sing, and the movie ends. Well, I am joined today by a special guest to help review this classic American movie, A Charlie Brown Christmas. We have Dennis Gravy on, a member of the Industrial Workers of the World and the Maryland Buck Abolitionist Collective. Thanks for coming on to the Old Mole today, Dennis.
Yeah, glad to be here.
So, Dennis, you had emailed me about this because we know each other and said, hey, I really like this movie. It's an all-time American classic and has some interesting things going on in it that I think we could talk about on the Old Mole, about American society and just kind of the ongoing struggle for liberation. So why did you want to talk about this?
Well, I always liked the movie. I grew up with it. I watched it as a kid, but I wasn't necessarily my nostalgia that I keep on watching it every year. I really just like the tone. I think it's a really aesthetically beautiful and almost poetic piece. But now watching it again with a political lens and trying to make a review of it, I think it opens up some really fascinating conversations.
Yeah, I mean, the film's explicit like message or kind of plot concern has to do with what in the movie is referred to as commercialism, which for different viewers has resonated as kind of a euphemism for capitalism. I do think that this is a bit different than consumerism, but maybe we can try to address that later. You think this film resonates with American culture in a way that allows us to talk about race.
What does race have to do with this film?
Yeah, well, I don't think it directly talks about any of that, but given its own narrative and its own place in American history, like just situating it in time, I think it offers some really interesting opportunities to have to open those conversations. So my sense of the movie is that it's sort of this narrative of Charlie Brown trying to find authenticity, right? He's recognizing a kind of alienation and a kind of inauthenticity in the everyday life within American capitalism. I think we have to be very clear that the commercialism that he's decrying is a product of commodified labor and a commodity society. So he goes through various stages of trying to get involved. He starts with this massive depression, which he continues the rest of the time, which is an indication of a kind of realism, right? He can't hold up this lie. And he's trying to find ways to get his grip on the world. The suggestion of Lucy to go get involved, quote unquote, is a first brush to become a boss, right? That's his first attempt to find authenticity, is to find some command ownership over other people's work in the form of being a director. And that fails mostly because he doesn't have any legitimate authority. His workers don't respect him, and he doesn't have a way to actually bridge that gap within the situation. And so he leaves and he says, we're going to get a tree. And he goes and he sees, okay, so this is not what I wanted. I don't want these big aluminum trees. I want something authentic. And he does the next stage, which is embracing the marginal, right? He goes and finds the weak and the feeble and the meek, and he embraces and says, this is authenticity, right? It's something that is forgotten and lost and no one cares about. Brings his tree back. And then he gets decried, right? People don't care about this. And in some ways he sees this wasn't an answer, right? So what's the next stage? The next stage is when he says, doesn't anybody know what Christmas really means? And Linus gets in and says, I know what Christmas means, and recites the Bible, the true biblical definition of Christmas. And I think there's an important moment there. I always grew up loving that moment because of its stillness, and biblical language is actually very beautiful. But there's a way that it falls flat. And watching it, especially again as an adult, after Linus does his recitation, there's a quiet, and the only thing that Charlie Brown can do is walk away. Because it doesn't work. It's not enough. It doesn't fix the tree. It doesn't fix how he feels. It's almost like a dictionary definition of what Christmas means. And he goes off and he attempts one last time. His last stage is his own personal capacity. He says, I'm going to fix this tree. And he goes, and after his final betrayal of his faithful companion dog, but he takes the ornament off of Snoopy's house, puts it on the tree, and it's destroyed. And he has this one beautifully depressed, beautifully self-brutal line.
Everything I touch gets ruined.
And then he wanders away. And then there's a final moment of redemption that I think is, to some extent, can we understand as a moral of the story, or we could understand as a moral of the story, where his workers, right? In this context, they were his employees. They come to the tree and they have some sympathy for it. They find collectively some sympathy. And what do? They do this magic that you talked about. And the magic is their collective labor. They sort of mass into this spinning ball of hands, and they take all the decorations off the doghouse and wave themselves on the tree, and the tree becomes magically transformed into a beautiful icon of authenticity. And Charlie Brown comes back, and he is embraced by them in a joyous cry of Merry Christmas, and then they sing in a sort of beloved community sort of feeling. And I think that to me is maybe against the grain, but a hopeful narrative reading of the piece as it stands, founded in the idea of collective labor as a form of solidarity.
It's a film that casts all white characters. There isn't an African-American character in Charles Schulz comics until he creates Franklin in 1968, 3 years after Charlie Brown Christmas. And it's telling a story about capitalism and the way in which it impinges on Christmas, which I think is coded for American culture as like white culture. Obviously, African Americans and people of other races and ethnicities have taken on the Christian religion, but in America, it is tied, I think, most heavily to white identity. And so it is the natural go-to for the dominant society's idea of how capitalism is undermining its roots, while not really allowing for any reflection on how its roots are part of its own malaise. And so that's why it focuses on Christianity, but it doesn't leave too many windows for seeing a broader kind of multicultural, multi-ethnic full American society that is also grappling with quote-unquote commercialism, and how that doesn't just take away the good feeling of the season, but actually makes life objectively miserable.
And I think that we should stick for a second on whether this final moment of authenticity is actually viable, is actually legitimate, because I think reflecting on it, it doesn't really work. Right, I think not only because we have this implied blind spot of anyone else who doesn't look like the people on the screen, but we also have just the fact that there's been no transformation of everyday life. There's just been a collective embrace for a brief moment, and Charlie Brown's depression isn't over. The rest of Charlie Brown continues to happen, and he's a very depressed child for the rest of the Peanuts universe. And so there is a way in which that kind of solidarity that I think the movie does profess fails, and fails miserably in its job.
When they go searching for the tree in the end, they're going through the tree lot, which in the 1960s could very well be populated by aluminum trees in addition to just regular cut farm trees. And when they find the little underdog tree, which, you know, has a lot of appeal because of the underdog narrative in American culture and maybe across cultures, they take it back, and, you know, it's not physically able of supporting the traditional ornaments. I mean, all that Charlie Brown puts on it is a bulb, which doesn't weigh anything, and it still pulls it over. It emphasizes the, like, burden of what that spectacle is for this little, albeit authentic, tree. And when the cast of the play dress it up, they pull all of the inauthentic decorations off of Snoopy's house, which just won first prize for the decoration contest, and they use it as the material to transform the tree into something that just doesn't look like the tree that we saw, which only had like four or five branches. It's now this full conical shaped green, beautiful, covered with bulbs and ribbons, like I said, spectacle of its former self. And in a way, that's satisfying, and it's supposed to represent the satisfaction they're after. And yet, I think if we pay attention to where they just were, we realize that it takes its cues for that satisfaction from the very culture that is leaving it dissatisfied.
Yeah, and I think that part of why I brought up the aesthetic that I like about it, that aesthetic feels very authentic and feels very profound, but I agree that the kind of cosmology that it still operates with is a commodified cosmology. This movie was actually funded by Coca-Cola, right? And Coca-Cola is one of the originary American producers of Christmas as a commodity. So the exact thing that Charlie Brown is decrying is the thing that makes this whole movie possible. And adding on this level of authenticity to what is ultimately, objectively, an inauthentic life world.
So let's talk about race again.
Thinking about race offers a really important opportunity to problematize that moral that I mentioned that I brought out of this, and I think give some deep lessons for what a workers' revolution means and how it could be possible. So the end of this movie to me is not satisfying. Just let's be real. Charlie Brown is not going to stop being depressed after this movie. Charlie Brown's friends are not going to stop being really mean to him after this movie. And the commodified culture is not going to go away as a constituent of the everyday life as part of this movie.
And the Charlie Brown franchise depends on that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the question then is, what is holding together that everyday life for those kids that this moment of solidarity, embrace of labor doesn't do, right? And to me, we can look at it by thinking about jazz. And thinking about cool, right? Because what allows the other kids to get through the day that Charlie Brown can't access? It's dancing to jazz, right? When they're doing the play and they start dancing, Lucy goes, "Isn't this great?" And Charlie Brown goes, "No, this is terrible. This is not Christmas." In the end, then, white society and white solidarity, the solidarity of white labor that I think this movie has a moral of, is founded on the domination of the black subject, is founded on white supremacy. And it's that foundation that holds it back from actually achieving any revolutionary transformation of society. We have a vision in this movie of a Norman Rockwell solidarity of labor that is also a solidarity with imperialism. So this is one thing then that it would take to have this labor solidarity mean actual transformation and abolition of commodity society. It would mean radically abolishing white supremacy and the liberation of the black subject.
Yeah, in a way, we're not saying that that's what should be in the film itself, per se, as far as its story, but because those are the conditions of the American society and culture that have produced this or helped to produce this comic, those conditions limit the possibility of its own vision achieving what it promises to, which is, you know, being happy with doing stuff together again.
Totally.
Well, that is all the time that we have for this review of A Charlie Brown Christmas. I would like to thank Dennis Gravy of the Industrial Workers of the World and the Marilyn Buck Abolitionist Collective for coming on.
Thanks so much, yeah.
I'm Jill Clement.
You have been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michelle. This is KBOO's Catalog of Connections year-end campaign to raise $75,000. You can connect with us by becoming a member and giving to KBOO. So please go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 or click the red donate box in the mobile app or mail your paper check to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. And if you already are a member, thank you. Thank you to all the members and volunteers and staff at KBOO who keep us connected. Thanks to today's contributors to the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks to Joe Clement and Dennis Gravy for giving us a leftist analysis of A Charlie Brown Christmas. Thanks to Bill Resnick and Alexandra Holmstrom-Smith for their conversation about anti-oppressive holidays. Thanks to Malcolm Shabazz Hoover and Daniel Grady for sharing their experience with Black Futures Farm. And to Tim Rice and Desiree Helligers for production and coordination help. The Old Mole will be back next week with fresh radio product on eco-disasters in film, The Great Derangement, and Palestine.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy